And therefore, and somehow we're not there. Anyway, hopefully you guys can see us. You're watching Deprogram. It's Ted Rall and Jamal Thomas, and it is Friday, May 8th, 2026. Good morning, JT. How are you doing?
What's going on, man? Doing okay.
Good, good. I'm gonna see if I can. Oh, there we are. I can see myself now. Okay, cool. It's weird. By the way, one problem is my head is always too big compared to yours and Robbie's, and I'm always like, I don't know how you guys could be so far back and still see your screen. Maybe it's because I'm older than you guys, but I'm like, if I'm not this close, I can't read anything. So that's why, I'm not trying to take up all this real estate. I just can't help it.
Oh, you're fine. I mean, my screen is like right here. My thing is like literally right on top of the laptop.
I wonder if you know what? Maybe I can adjust my camera too, so that I
Yeah,
look
I just have my
further.
camera like right behind the laptop, and the laptop is directly under it, the thing pushed back.
Okay, well, that's what
It's
it is.
relatively close. I guess that's what I'm saying.
Gotcha. Okay. All right. Well, so anyway, thanks everyone for tuning in. Please like, follow, and share the show. We're here Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. Eastern time, and some interesting stories today.
Oh yeah.
Breaking just before we went on the air, the new Labor Department data just came out. The U.S. economy added an anemic 111,000 jobs. They like to see 400,000 a month last month, so that's not too great. Unemployment rate is staying more or less steady, but it seems like the latest economic expansion is decidedly cooling off in the light of the war, although obviously you're not going to really see the full effect of that for probably several more months. Trump, interesting story, seems to be screwing up his relationship with Saudi Arabia, which up until now has been a very reliable ally to the United States and to Trump. I would ask the Saudis about this myself, but I'm a journalist and I really don't want to have my throat slit cut and be cut into pieces and dissolved in acid and dumped into the sewer system, because so that kind of sucks. But we'll talk about that. Big election results out of the UK as anticipated yesterday. Keir Starmer's Labour Party is suffering a lot in these council elections throughout the UK and parliamentary elections in Scotland and Wales. Reform UK, that's under Nigel Farage, made big gains with hundreds of local council seats in working class areas. Not as much coverage yet about the Greens. And perhaps my most amusing story, I think, today is well, the Washington Post. They said it's almost like they listened to you yesterday, JT, talk about billionaires and how nobody can really earn $1 billion. And the Washington Post wrote a whole editorial. I mean, the Washington Post, I think, is owned by some sort of billionaire, if I remember
I think
correctly.
so. I think so.
Yeah. And so anyway, and then last, I know I said that one was last, but last and probably least, but still funny, Melania Trump was talking at a Mother's Day event for military mothers, and she talked about how empathetic her husband, the president, is, and the crowd, a very friendly crowd, like laughed.
Oh, did
So that's pretty funny. Anyway, if you have a question for us about those or any other topics, please put them into the live feed into the live chats in Rumble or YouTube, if you're watching in the 9 a.m. hour, and we will get to those. Producer Robbie West will filter through, feed them up. Priority is going to go to Rumble rants and super chats because those are paid for. But as you guys know, we do try to get to all of them. And thank you for that dollar donation that just came in. Speaking of which, much appreciated. Okay, so what would you like to talk about first?
that's interesting. So, there was one story that you didn't mention was Trump is seemingly the clashes that were taking place in the Middle East on the Strait of Hormuz, where apparently the United States fired on an oil tanker, hit the oil tanker. Iran responded with force. The U.S. military apparently brings in warships. Those warships are fired upon by Iran. Iran is saying that they hit the warships. U.S. is saying not so much, but the U.S. has been lying remorselessly all throughout this about the damage that they've effectively taken on the bases, or for that matter, the people that were either hurt or injured, etc. the U.S. eventually did a bombing run on multiple locations. I think it was like three locations in the islands around Iran that are in Iran. So like this is heating up. This is not cooling down. Both sides still claim that the ceasefire is in play. And I guess this gets to the whole Saudi thing. The Project Freedom thing, they're reporting, stopped because Saudi Arabia and Kuwait shut their airspace to the United States. Apparently, that is reopened, according to Trump. I haven't heard that from Saudi Arabia and Kuwait yet. But it's interesting. Yeah, the relationship between these countries are souring on some level. I guess we can hit that one first.
Yeah, yeah, let's do that one. I mean, look, I thought it was fascinating. One really amusing thing, and I guess this would probably be annoying to President Trump, is, you know, Prince MBS, Mohammed bin Salman, he of the bone saw, he encouraged, by all accounts, Trump to attack Iran. He thought this would be a good idea. He advised him to do it. But now he's had enough, right? Like now where he currently is at is he's looking for stability. He wants to, have Saudi Arabia have a more outward view to the world, be less isolated. He wants the kingdom to attract tourism. He's, and all of this is just basically not good for business. I'm not really clear on why he would have thought that attacking Iran would have been good for business before he gave that advice to Donald Trump. But whatever, once it started, he decided he didn't like it. And I think he got really – so the reporting is that he got very angry when Trump asked to use Saudi bases and Saudi airspace in order to supply Operation Freedom, which is his short-lived 36-hour-long effort to escort neutral flagged ships through the Strait of Hormuz. Obviously, MBS saw that as a provocation toward the Iranians, right? I mean, it's like, look, you guys say you're trying to negotiate not just a ceasefire, but also a permanent peace deal. And yet here you are like always poking at the bear, right? And so like, why the fuck are you doing that? Well, you can do that, but don't do it with us. Trump apparently was really surprised and shocked that MBS was mad at him about this. And he ended up going out and Operation Freedom is no more. And just sort of parenthetically, we were told that Operation Epic Fury had ended with the 60-day War Powers Act deadline, and that Operation Freedom was now replacing it. Now Trump is again saying, well, no, Operation Epic Fury continues, which of course prompts the question, what about the War Powers Act then, which we are now like way past the 60-day deadline, and where's the Republican Congress? So there's a lot of questions here. I guess my first one for you, JT, is, what do you think is on MBS's mind that he was in favor of this? He was for it until he was against it.
See, that's more complicated, right? I mean, because it depends on where the reporting is coming from. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of the, especially like Axios, many of the publications, Financial Times, these guys are just Western journalists. I'm not clear they have any sources in Iran at all. And so, meaning, is it the situation that... It's all speculation. I mean, because the reality of it is, as you point out, what did Saudi Arabia think was going to happen? It didn't. I'm not even certain that Donald Trump was speaking with his allies in the region. Meaning, from my understanding, the Gulf states didn't know that Trump was going to do this, that they effectively did this attack. Now, it's possible MBS pushed Trump to do it because I was never one of those people that believed the relationship between Saudi Arabia and Iran was real. I know China brokered a deal between the two, but that's overt. What happens behind the scenes, right? When these guys
they're not even frenemies.
Yeah, that's my point, right? By the same token, did Saudi Arabia really think that they were going to get out unscathed? I mean, if you think of the Houthis, if you remember, the Houthis flew a drone, hit the oil fields, and took down 5% of the world's oil with the drone. When the Patriot missiles couldn't necessarily stop that drone. And so it's like, what did you think was going to happen with Iran if indeed you attacked Iran? They kept saying we're going to hit the Gulf states. So maybe Saudi Arabia thought the missile defense was going to somehow protect them. But it's also possible that the reporting is getting it wrong, that it was really the conversation between Trump and Netanyahu that was the impetus for it. I don't know. I mean, because reporting is reporting. Like, it's not, you know, oftentimes it's not necessarily the truest thing in the world. Because I agree with you. What did they think was going to happen? Either way, even if the reporting was true, as you point out, they had a change of heart when bombs started falling and they realized the bases weren't going to protect them, in which case they shut the airfield down. I think the interesting question is, what happens now? Like, do the Gulf states still go with this idea that these bases are somehow some kind of protection from Iran? Or at this point, do they realize these bases are magnets for attacks and they have to actually deal with a hegemon in the region?
I think it's going to depend on this, on the specific politics of each individual Gulf state, and that they're, and some of them are going to peel. We're going to see a bell curve of responses. We're going to have on one end of the bell curve, you have the UAE, which is apparently the Emiratis are doubling down on their alliance with the U.S. And the Israelis. And they think that that's where safety lies and where their fate, their economic and military fate lies. And then on the other hand, I think you're going to look at countries like Qatar, and they're going to say like, yeah, maybe we need to make better friends with the people in Tehran. And then there's going to be a whole range of responses in between. Not to mention there are divisions in the ruling classes, as we Marxists like to say, within each Gulf state, and there's going to be a debate that's going to follow, like at internal, Iranian attacks or whatever these developments are. I mean, I think it's going to be a hodgepodge, right? We know that we think of the Gulf states speaking as one, but they don't. And, what Bahrain decides to do is not going to be, what Qatar decides to do or whatever, or Sharjah. So it's going to be just going to be completely different. I think, but one thing's for sure, the idea of just being falling in lockstep behind the U.S. and then by extension Israel, those days are over.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, hell, Israel had troops on UAE soil, for God's sake. I mean, that's just outrageous.
That's crazy.
Iran is considered an enemy at this point, effectively, as you point out, because the U.S. has effectively doubled down. I mean, the UAE has doubled down. It will be interesting. Because I think the old rules have changed. Like, this idea of, do you know how sometimes, like, in courts, like, a government wouldn't necessarily, like, for example, the Voting Rights Act. Obama didn't necessarily want to go and take that to court because he knew the Voting Rights Act was going to get ripped limb from limb. But belief being that if you have, at the very least, it there, even if it's somewhat depowered, it's still somewhat of a deterrence. But the moment that you test that deterrence is going to fall apart. So you don't necessarily want to test the deterrence. Mm. In the case of the Gulf states, well, that has been tested and found wanting. And so now the catch becomes, okay, now what? I mean, you've had these bases there for what, 50, 60 years. And it was a deterrent up to the point where you're attacked and you realize that deterrent was nonsense. Now that it's found to be nonsense, now what? Oh, that's interesting. That's going to be interesting.
Well, I mean, a lot of this is about technology, right? I mean, yes. The repeated bombing attacks against Iran over the years have prompted the Iranians to build a lot of underground missile bases and to bury their nuclear facilities so that they're more impenetrable. We have drone technology, which is far more advanced. And obviously, the Russians were, doing a really great job with cheap, affordable drones and supplying both knowledge and the hard technology to the Iranians. There's a lot of, sort of unforeseen responses to, it's a lot of unforeseen consequences to stuff that the U.S. and Israel did to Iran over the years. They have tempered Iran. They've made, what they say doesn't kill you, makes you stronger. And right. Iran has gotten stronger. We haven't, we took a swing at the king, but we didn't, we didn't kill him. And so now, they're a formidable opponent, not to mention they have these mid-range missiles that can wreak havoc all over the place. Even with that sort of empty one that hit Diego Garcia in the middle of the Indian Ocean. I mean, that's a big deal. I mean, there's a lot to unpack here. I mean, Also, I think what's interesting about the Saudi-U.S. relationship is you have two similar figures, right? I mean, MBS is in many ways also a volatile, temperamental person, much like Donald Trump, you know, given to spasms of anger, the kind of guy who, just like Donald Trump, announces a 100-mile-long city in the middle of the desert called The Line to great fanfare and says this is the future of Saudi Arabia. And then a week ago, without, you know, so like a bored billionaire with his toy, drops it and says, yeah, we're not going to do that. You know, I mean, it's just like, it's
I wish you didn't do it. I was fascinated by it.
Oh, me too.
I don't know if the audience knows what we're talking about. Do you want to explain it? Like,
basically, yeah. So in the middle, you know, obviously Saudi Arabia is famously a land of vast deserts at dunes. You know, you've seen Lawrence of Arabia. And so, you know, their biggest problem is ecologically is water supply. So one attempt to solve this was this idea for this city that was going to be basically, well, like the name is, it's a line. But it's like basically like half a mile to a mile wide and maybe 100 miles long, connected by trains that run the entire distance. And people would live alongside them, live and work and recreate alongside it. And the idea was that there were sort of ecological, environmental futurists who thought that this would be a more efficient way of disseminating water. And, you know, they would have all sorts of enclosed, like geosphere type systems where you have plants, big plants growing inside, basically kind of giant human terrariums. It would have been fascinating to see if, yeah, first of all, anyone was willing to live there and whether it would work. We are going to a, Saudi Arabia is not, you know, an oddity. Much of the world is going to look drier and hotter the way Saudi Arabia does now. So it would be nice to see if they could make something like that work.
Yeah, it would have been interesting. I mean, it was going to be like a skyscraper tall, going all the way like for a mile. I mean, with all sorts of like levels, and each level had like the machinery, living space, all of this stuff. Supposedly you can get to any point along the line in a short period of time. But again, they're doing this in the desert. Like, it's a little, it was aggressive. Not to mention, it wasn't just the line. There were multiple locations that they were building stuff like this for. It puts me in the mind of the Venus Project. That's why I was super interested in it. But the Venus Project was circular because they wanted you to be able to get to pretty much anywhere in this kind of rotation technique.
Now you have to explain the Venus Project.
All right, so Jack Fresco was a futurist and came up with this idea of the Venus Project, basically reshaping Earth into a technological future where machines do much of the labor in order to create abundance. Basically, our current system is based on scarcity. Scarcity is the thing that allows prices to remain high. Abundance would be this idea that we're no longer working with this idea of making cash. We're working for a resource-based economy, an economy based on resources. With machines doing much of the labor and human being using their capabilities for other things that are more important. The purpose wouldn't necessarily be cash. The purpose would be to make abundance for everybody. Now, there are difficulties in this plan. One of it is, who does the labor? How do you decide where you live? These things kind of come into play. Who chooses what gets done? Because at this point, you're talking about some like a planned economy kind of ish. He would say it's not planned. He would argue that there are sensors all throughout the resources in order to give some kind of determination about how many resources you have and how much do you actually need. But of course, the question becomes, who chooses, right? It's an interesting idea, but that's what it sounded like to me, but just kind of a weirder version of it. But yeah, obviously it ran into difficulties.
I like the comparison for sure. We have some comments and questions, so we should do those and then we can move on. Darkworks, for a Friday spice question, Fry-yay, as Manila would say, what is an African-American? Is Elon Musk an African-American? Happy Friday. Well, as the white guy here, I'm going to let you answer that question.
What the hell? Okay.
Wow. Well,
oh, you answer that?
No, you're going to answer that.
Oh,
please, please. Like, I want to weasel out of it.
I mean, is Elon Musk even an American? Is Elon Musk even American?
Is he a U.S. citizen? I don't know.
You can say it. Look, if you want to say South American and white South Americans are Africans, fair enough. And by definition or technical definition, I suppose he would be considered an African American. Mm-hmm. I don't think he fits the typical definition of an African American.
Right. No, I mean, yeah, I mean, it's like this is, I mean, race is a series of constructs, which is why these questions sort of never have a good solid answer, because it's sort of like, oh, well, you know, I mean, I don't know. It's like French people aren't really French. They're German. You know what I mean? It's like,
don't tell them that. Don't tell them that.
It all came to, you know, it really kind of, there's this book called The Mummies of Urumqi, Urumqi, amazing book. And basically, it really opened my mind to this, my eyes to this idea of like race and like identity as being so fluid and fungible and like as to be like something we probably should stop talking about as much. But like, basically, it talks about how these archaeologists in Western China, in Xinjiang, in Muslim Central Asian part of China, opened up a tomb from thousands of years ago, and they found that they were startled to find that basically it looked like he looked like a Scotsman, the guy who was buried in there. He had like basically the classic Scottish plaid quilt pattern on the fabric, that the shroud that he was buried in. And then they started finding finds across the Silk Road, traveling west all the way to Scotland, that showed similar patterns. And it indicates that these people migrated that direction, right? That basically people who then lived in what is today China ended up in Scotland. Then they bounced back across like what is today Northern Russia. And people are always moving around so much that kind of like, you know, we're sort of, because, you know, in 2026, we are all people who came of age in the, you know, the modern post-Metternich nation state, you know, mindset. We think that's frozen solid and that these borders are somehow created by God, but they kind of, not for 99.999% of human history, right? So anyway.
Yeah, agree. I mean, we infuse it with the way we think about it. I mean, sure, agree. I mean, but it's, have you ever seen American Gods?
Oh, yeah. Jay Swerven is saying, don't forget about the Google Chrome story.
Right. I'm not going to go to American Gods. I was just going to make a point of saying, in the same way that the gods were created by constructs, it's kind of very similar. Like, we have these constructs of race and stuff like that we infuse our point of view. I mean, it becomes a thing at the point where people think it's a thing, if that makes sense.
So Google Chrome, we can do really quickly. We didn't get to do it yesterday. Very simply, if your computer, if your hard drive has enough free room, Google, whether you like it or not, puts this AI model on your Chrome browser, and it, God knows what it's spying on. God knows what it does. It's AI, so maybe in a sense, Google doesn't really know what it does. I just think there, you know, and I talked a little bit with Robbie about this on TMI. I think there should be a law that, like, if a tech company wants to put something substantial, I don't know how you would define that, not like just a security patch, let's say, but like something novel, something that has a meaningful effect on your operating system, you should have to have positive buy-in. It should ask for your approval and say, in simple language, we would like to add this thing to you. Here's what it is. Do you want it? Yes or no? It shouldn't just be slapped on the way that, the iPhones came, that one generation of iPhones all came with the U2 album that nobody wanted.
Would it matter? Like, meaning, even if they did that, would it matter? Like, and what I mean by that is, I agree with you. There should be laws for this stuff. It's like technology is racing ahead of of the legal framework in order to do anything about that technology, whether it's spying, whether it's flying killer robots, robots swimming in water or whatever, right? Or dolphins with lasers, that Pegasus would not confirm or deny, apparently. which is the dumbest thing in the world, right? But would it matter? So say, for example, you try to load Chrome. Chrome writes 5 pages, and at the very bottom it says confirm. Mm-hmm. Who the hell is reading those 5 pages?
Well, that's now, what I'm saying. Very simple language is really key.
But will people forego using Chrome for that reason?
Probably not. Not most of them.
I agree with you, though. It should be there. But it's like until there are alternatives, it's kind of hard to.
Yeah, it's like the Democratic, and we're going to talk about the English elections. But it's like how we have the Democratic and the Republican parties, and nothing else is viable, so we're stuck.
It's kind of that. Yeah. I mean, it's like the brain chip. The moment that people start using it,
That's it. Sense. Yeah. That's right. I don't think it would matter in the long run, but at least, I guess, in this case, knowledge is not really power, but knowledge is better than ignorance.
Agreed.
I mean, if I'm being raped, I kind of want to know I'm being raped. You know, I don't want to be like the lady in France who was raped by her husband's buddies for years.
Oh, that was the one who was being drugged?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Jesus.
Yeah, that was a crazy story. Manchild, thanks for the $2. Between Keir Starmer's losses and Trump's struggles with MBS, are we witnessing the beginning of a total collapse of the establishment playbook on both sides of the Atlantic? We should get into the English. Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, like, Trump has fallen apart. He's failed in pretty much every objective that he set for himself. Mm-hmm.
Although he was supposed to be anti-establishment.
He's supposed to be. Mm-hmm. Supposed to be. Not so much. And from the standpoint of, like, British politics, I mean, like, the Nigel Farage thing is fascinating. Mm. Because for all intents and purposes, you're talking about this kind of hostile takeover of the Conservatives. It's just of the Tories.
Well, or the in the UK example, it's the replacement of the Conservatives, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you may very well have at the end of the next couple of months, the UK's two major parties may well be the Greens and Reform UK. Labour and the Conservatives may basically be no more.
Yeah, there'll be a sea change. There'll be a sea change. I mean, I remember when Boris Johnson got in. I mean, because people need to put this in context. If you remember when Boris Johnson ran against Jeremy Corbyn, Boris Johnson beat the stuffing out of Jeremy Corbyn. In fact, Boris Johnson was winning districts that because the Tories never won. There were people who had been, who, when the district started, the guy was in the district and was part of Labour. What is Skinner, I believe his name is. I could be getting it wrong. Got taken out when Boris Johnson came in. Like, it's hard to get across how the power of the second election of Boris Johnson took over when he beat the stuff out of Jeremy Corbyn during the referendum debate. Not anymore. What a difference, 4-8 years makes?
No, agreed. By the way, what do you make of the fact that some of the districts and cities that have turned toward Reform UK, which is a right-wing nativist party, are actually a majority like Pakistani, Bangladeshi, Indian, these are South Asian, a lot of people of color, and those districts seem to be going for reform. I mean, is this a case of, you know, sort of like with Latinos in the United States where people come in, they pull the ladder up the treehouse after themselves, and they're like, well, we got ours, so we don't care about anyone else, or is it more complicated than that, or is it more, hey, assimilation has really worked, or I don't know.
I can't answer that. That's a tough one. Because, you know, you're right. In the U.S., that's an odd phenomenon, right? It's like, we're in. We like it here. Let's make sure nobody else comes.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know. I got to be honest. I don't know. I hadn't followed the individual particular details of, like, the grouping breakdown in regards to these groups. Because it's a little bit weird. You're right. It's a nativist party. Like, these guys will be heavy in favor of kicking people out of the country and that type of stuff. I don't know. I don't know. I don't have an answer for that one.
And of course, the thing is, we're going to know more by Monday, right? Because the votes are still being counted in these council elections. There's that. And also, I don't know, should we, before we move on, do you think we should read a lot into these British election results, considering that these are so hyper-local, right? I mean, people are not voting based on the party when they vote for their, you know, their council representative in their little neighborhood. They're voting for the the lady or the dude that they happen to know from down the pub, right?
Kind of. I mean, people do look at the council elections to get tea leaves in regards to what takes place in the larger elections when they do for parliament.
Yeah.
No, I think it matters. I think it matters just like it does here. Like when you're seeing, because I think top ticket does fall down on some level, meaning it does trickle down. When people are voting for, let's say, a Congress member, they are looking at the president, despite the fact that they're also looking at their Congress member. I do think,
but they're more looking at their congressman, right? Like if you like your, you know, I mean, if you like your congressperson, you know, you're not paying that much attention to their party as you do if it's a candidate. I think you pay more attention to the party on candidates you don't know, maybe.
Yes, you know. True. But do you
and
really
for,
know?
And for the higher up on the ticket, the more you pay attention.
And how the worse the higher up on a ticket is, you pay attention. Like, meaning, if you believe that these Republicans have fell in line with Trump, and Trump is sitting at 23% to independents, you're paying attention to Trump. Because you know that Republican going in is going to fall in line. And if you hate what he is doing, you're going to look at your politician. I could be wrong with this, but I think it matters. Like, I do think people look at it. Now, fair enough. I think you're right. If it's somebody who you know, it's like, I've known this guy for God knows how many years.
You went to school together.
Yeah, exactly. That's one thing. But the catch is, what does the majority of the people do? Or what does the preponderance of people do when they're going to the polls? Especially if it's some rando or somebody they don't entirely know, or they're just getting into politics, or they're just looking at the president saying he needs to be stopped. I think they take it out on the congressman. And I think the same thing's true in the UK.
Yeah, it is complicated, right? For sure. Okay, so let's see. The real time bot, would you support a plan to close borders temporarily until current U.S. residents were taken care of? For example, health care for everyone, food on all tables, etc. Afterwards, well, it would be wrong not to have a conversation like this involving producer Robbie West. So I'm going to put him on there. I would favor that. I think maybe with the exceptions of, for example, if you have, you know, Afghan traders who worked for the U.S. and need to come to the United States so we can save them from being killed. You know, we have a moral obligation to people like that. But otherwise, I kind of think, look, I don't understand why we would import a product that we don't need. And a product would be, in this case, people, workers, who, you know, in a country that has unemployment. You know, it's like I'm an anti-free trader when it comes to things like the United States makes cars. We should not import foreign cars. We make them. We must import bananas because we don't grow enough bananas for the demand here. So I think we should only be importing things that we need and can't get here. And otherwise, why are we importing them, gentlemen?
Close the border, do mass deportations in accordance to law. So that means you get a warrant. If there's people here illegally, you round them up, you send them back home. If a country will not take their citizens back, you turn off remittances. So that way there's real economic pressure on those governments. For example, Mexico makes more in remittances than they do off their oil markets, which to me is insane, but that's true. And those are pressures that we can have. So you don't need to deport your migrants to South Sudan to be drafted into the army. I mean, by definition, the entire purpose of a government is to provide for the welfare of its citizens. And I mean, this is not controversial. That's why I blew up on that guy yesterday at the end of the show. It's just like, I don't understand why this is so hard for some people to understand. We have homeless people living under every single bridge in this country. We have massive.
Well, not under every single bridge. Some bridges are still empty. So,
well, give us time with the
USA. Give us time with the gas prices. USA.
I mean, seriously. I mean, no, give it price. No, give it time. But where the gas prices are, the economy is imploding. I mean, at the end of the day, though, honestly, it is not our responsibility to take care of the entire world. It is not our responsibility to provide free health care to the entire world.
This was never about taking care of the world. This was always about cheap labor for capital, right?
No, 100%. But people on the left, though, they always lean into the humanitarian argument. That's the person you yelled at yesterday.
Clearly, is like sort of like, you know, thinking of the Statue of Liberty in New York Harbor, and like, you know, we need to be there needs to be a welcoming place that people can come to. And that's a tradition that we had. And I think it's based on emotion. It's not really based on,
100%
economic and political reality.
100%. And then the golden age of American immigration up till Biden decided to throw open the borders, there wasn't a welfare state. And more immigrants went back to where they came from than stayed here. People forget to mention that part. There was no welfare state back then. And
when are you talking about?
Well, but no, back in the 1800s.
Yeah, that's immigration correct.
Coming from Europe.
That is correct.
But you know, facts are racist.
Although there were kind of informal privatized things like the Tammany Hall political machine in New York, which they would send representatives to greet Irish arrivals in other countries and basically say like, hey, you know, welcome. And they like, we have an apartment for you. We have a job for you. But of course, we're going to expect you to vote our way. And if we, you know, someday your godfather may ask you for a favor, that day may never come. like that, right?
Yeah, for sure.
JT, what do you think we should do? Border?
So I think you're right about, I would accept that, meaning the take care of citizens. I mean, like, meaning if it was a compromise, if it came up and said, okay, we have three big items. And those three big items are universal health care, slash the military budget, free education, but we got to close the borders in order to do it. And we're going to hire many of these people for jobs that are effectively living under bridges, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, I would go for that. I mean, I would consider myself an American first on this stuff. Even though that's not the way it's really cast. Yeah, I'll go for it.
I don't like the fact that patriotism and America first are the province of the right. Like, fuck that. Yeah,
because I don't fuck even that. Understand why that's the case.
And I don't see why the left cedes that territory.
Yeah, neither do I.
Go ahead, JT. I'm sorry. I stepped
on. No, go for it. Go for it. I want to hear you.
Love you too, baby. Talking to the wife. She's headed out to work. But no, I mean, it's just... No, to y'all's point, I don't understand it either, because the Republican Party has always been the party of the country club. You know, the rich people going to the golf courses, sipping their drinks, getting on the golf course, you have your little caddy out. That's the Republican Party of yore. And now all of a sudden, it seems like that's the whole reason that there's a civil war going on in the America First movement with Trump, is for whatever reason, the Democratic Party decided to embrace social issues and tried to play on all these wedge issues instead of actually addressing real issues like what Hugo Chavez would have about.
I can tell you why that happened. I mean, look, it's very simple. In the same way that throughout the Cold War, the United States liked to deal with dictators more than democracies because it was easier. Like if you meet Saddam Hussein and you're like, hey, I need you to do this and that, and Saddam says it's going to happen, it's going to happen. If you're dealing with like France and it's like, well, I have to go to my parliament and, you know, blah, blah, blah. It's like, ah, shit, it's a pain in the ass. Similarly, Democrats decided it was easier to suck up to Jeff Bezos and giant billionaires and corporations to get $1 million donation than to try to find, 100,000 people to give you 10 bucks each. That's basically it. It's just easier. And this was Bill Clinton's model in the 90s, yeah. Right? Where he decided like, we're not going to cede, corporate money to the Republicans anymore. We're going to go after it too. And it worked and it put a lot of money into the coffers of the Democratic Party. But of course, what's the deal with the devil? The Republicans are like, what do they want back in exchange? They want business-friendly policies, right? So business-friendly policies take away what the Democrat defined the Democratic Party since the great realignment of FDR in 1932, when the Democratic Party became the left-wing party instead of the Republican Party. And so then what does that leave? Then that creates a crisis inside the Democratic Party, which is, okay, well, we're no longer the party of Joe and Jane Sixpack. So what are we? We have to have something that still appeals to a progressive, non-conservative, non-corporatist. And then they're like, identity politics. Identity politics, we can go to our corporate masters and say, listen, this won't cost you anything at all. This costs you nothing. Your relationship with the working class remains exactly the same. You continue to exploit. We give you everything you want. You get to run the show and you get to own us. But yeah, you're going to have to, instead of exploiting old white guys, you're now going to be exploiting young Black women in the workplace. But you get to exploit. They just look different. That's exactly what happened.
But the problem is it destroys the entire country.
I'm just telling you what happened.
if this crap continues, we're going to get something far more radical than Donald Trump. And I do believe that. I mean that sincerely.
You guys are both students of history. It's like, this is a historical cycle. It had to happen this way. I mean, there was never going to be a world at which, say, Bill Clinton was considering this approach with the DNC in 92, where someone at the table, a young Bernie Sanders, was going to say, if we go this, it's better. I know it's hard, but we've got to get like the $100,000 donations. We need to do that because otherwise we will lose our soul. And then America will no longer have a left-leaning party that represents the interests of the working class, and it will lead to perdition. And okay, so if someone said something like that, and I suspect people like Jesse Jackson said things like that, and people like Howard Dean, John Edwards, they did say things like that. And they were all basically, ignored, because it's like the lure of that $1 million donation is just too big.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. One place I would push back on you when you're talking about, we have an obligation to take in the people that we've worked with as collaborators or traitors. I'm just using the word traitor because that's what they are.
That's what I used.
If you betray your country, you're the last person that I want, because it shows you have no moral character at all. I'm a very simple guy.
A country says, work with us. We need you to collaborate. We need you to be a traitor to your own country. Okay, fair enough. You've made a deal with the empire in this case. Now, you could say, well, you shouldn't have made that deal with the empire. Sad day for you if anything goes wrong. But is that really the perspective that the U.S. wants to give?
A Lannister always pays his debts. What this has to be.
Just from a philosophical, ethical, and credibility point.
It's a credibility standpoint. I agree with you, Robbie. These are not like the best people morally. Yeah. Okay.
Agreed.
They're little fucking worms is what they are.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, listen, if you betray your country, I have zero sympathy for you, and I have no obligation at all to take care of your treasonous self. You can stay there. You made your bed. If you sleep with dogs, you catch fleas, go with God.
Totally agree.
I do get it. And emotionally, I agree.
Emotionally, I totally agree. So the next question plays in nicely. So Manchild, thanks for the $2. Washington Post's motto, we can talk about that editorial, is democracy dies in darkness. But with Jeff Bezos pulling the strings on editorials, is it really journalism dies with daddy issues? So let me quote this some tidbits from this editorial in today's Washington Post, which made me howl with laughter. Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez doesn't just think there should be no billionaires. She believes accumulating that much wealth is inherently immoral, probably criminal, and definitely illegitimate. How does she grapple with the 3,400 or so people who have that much? You can break rules, she explained. You can abuse labor laws. You can pay people less than what they're worth. But you can't earn that, end quote. Now back to the Washington Post. To say that it's impossible to legitimately earn $1 billion bear in mind, this editorial board is owned by Jeff Bezos, the world's richest man, is to put an arbitrary limit on human potential and presuming that anyone who becomes too successful must be cheating shows a lack of imagination as to what humans are capable of accomplishing in a free society. I've saved the best for last, JT. The headline for this was, you, JT, can earn $1 billion.
No.
No, you can't. And nor can I.
You can't own $1 billion without people being shorted in regards to what they're being paid. Like, meaning, the fact that I have $1 billion means that they're poverty. Like, the money is not being used.
And there's no way to come. I'm with AOC. There's no way to come upon a fortune that vast, honestly. I mean, there's a certain level where it's like, you know, is it possible to have accumulated $2 million without fucking anyone too hard? Sure.
Yes.
You know, you could invent some. Yeah. Like, I know a lady. Oh, okay. So in Southampton in New York, there's a lady, she's the Tate's Cookies lady. You may have seen Tate's Cookies all over, you know, like Tate's Cookies in the supermarket. They're the best crispy cookies, right? Anyway, the point is they're everywhere. They're in 7-Eleven. They're in every supermarket in the country. But it started out, she got divorced. She started making her own cookies in her house. She started selling them at local craft fairs. And the cookies were really good. And people bought them, and she reinvested, bought a little cookie store that's still in Southampton, and they give away the broken cookies for free at the front of the store, which is really great. And, you know, and basically you, you know, it, and she became rich. Yeah. I don't know if she underpays any of her employees or anything like that, but I'm going to assume she doesn't. And, you know, sure. Now, can you become Jeff Bezos rich? Well, Jeff Bezos didn't become that rich by being a nice person. I mean, he subjects his workers to horrific, well-documented, massively terrible working conditions where people, like, you know, literally aren't allowed to have bathroom breaks. They have to piss in a bottle.
Pee in jars, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, people literally collapse from the heat in unair-conditioned Amazon facilities in the summer. And you know, from heat stroke, people have died on the job. I mean, so, you know, how did, and, you know, and there's all sorts of unethical shit that Amazon does. Like, for example, encourage people who have like their little business, like, oh, I invented a great new flashlight. I'm going to sell it through my Amazon store because my local store, brick and mortar store, is out of business because of Amazon. So you sell it on the Amazon virtual store, and then Amazon notices that you're doing well, and they copy your product, and then they undercut you, and they put you out of fucking business. Rinse, lather, repeat. I mean, you know, it's, who was it who said behind every great fortune is a crime? Voltaire. I mean, that's true.
Yeah, and apparently, if Voltaire said it, that goes back to the beginning. Right? Like, it's not like this is a recent phenomenon. It's not that. It's not that. I mean, for God's sake, we had the Gilded Age here in the States, right? Before the FDR era, even Trust Buster coming in as a president, going after the railroads and stuff like that. This is something that has been an issue going on for a very long time. And not just here, China. I know, like, we call it a communist country, but what they call it, communism with Chinese characteristics. Part of those characteristics are the billionaires that have been created in China with the wealth inequality that's taken place with the
economy. It's really a capitalist country with some socialist characteristics.
Yeah.
And a lot of red and yellow, you know, bunting.
I agree with you on this one. I just, the idea of somebody having that much money blows my mind, especially in the country. It's like the billionaire stepping over the homeless man. And you're like, okay, that's weird. And again,
Turner just died, right? And he said, and he famous, I heard an appreciation on NPR about him. I think he was a pretty cool guy for a rich guy. Obviously a visionary, did not underpay his workers, did not overcharge. I mean, you know, but became super rich. He gave away everything he owned, and like about 17 years before he died, he gave a speech where he said that his proudest accomplishment was giving away everything. everything. Wow. But I'm like, that's about the best you can expect from someone like that. But I don't like the fact that he has the power to pick and choose. You know, like Republicans don't like it when the government picks and chooses losers and winners in the marketplace. I don't like it when philanthropists pick winners and losers among arts organizations or anti-poverty organizations. I mean, no one person, not me, as awesome as I am, should have that much power.
Agreed. And more to the point, it's a political decision on whether or not they get that much money. That's not just God. Like, meaning that's not God proclaiming Jeff Bezos needs to have $100 billion. That is a political system full of the rich, the wealthy, the politically connected, that is effectively keeping the system in that way so they can earn that much money and get that much money. I mean, look at what Donald Trump is doing with the Build Back Better, the Big Beautiful Deal. That thing's going to put like trillions of dollars on the debt. I mean, they're talking about like $10, $15 trillion over the course of like, 10 years or something like that. The debt is going to go to like $50 trillion, which is mind-blowing. And yet, it is built in order to transfer wealth from the people who have it the least to the people who have the most. And I'm saying these are issues of policy. This is not a law, an act of God. So no, it's human potential. Human potential, my ass. Human potential to buy legislators in order to set laws in order to allow them to make.
Totally. Totally fucking ridiculous. Yeah. Let's see. I think we have an ad that I should read. Yes, we do. So, all right, let's do this. Okay. Okay. Still haven't tried 1775 coffee? Now's your shot. The 1775 starter kit just dropped, only 1,000 units. You're getting the bold, dark roast that hits hard, the smooth, medium roast, and the Vitality Mushroom Coffee for clean energy and laser focus, no crash. All single origin, small batch, toxin-free, and mold-free. Plus, you're also getting a gold spoon clip because freedom isn't scooped with plastic. A father strong enough to stir up your coffee and your mother-in-law's opinions, and a black 1775 tumbler. $170 worth of coffee and gear, yours for $99. This is for the ones who've been watching 1775 blow up on Rumble, wondering if it's actually worth it. Spoiler, it is. Go to 1775coffee.com/studio and grab your starter kit before they're gone. Bold beans, clean fuel, and a morning routine that stands for something just like Rumble does. Okay, more
questions. I got to get some of that coffee. It's like, that's a hot coffee. In the war, when things would blow up, when they were when Iran was fighting Israel, it's like, that coffee is hot. And it's like, watch videos.
Jack Samuels, thanks for the $4. Thoughts on the, $4.99. Thoughts on the Trump administration moving to let Americans ship handguns via the Postal Service, reversing a 1927 ban they claim as unconstitutional under the Second Amendment.
I had not heard that. As opposed to that being litigated. I mean, I suppose you could pass a law. That just feels dicey to me. I don't know.
I don't think you need a law. I mean, it seems like it's a regulatory matter, right? I mean, how does the Postal Service is quasi-governmental, right?
Sure.
But I think they can decide. FedEx will ship handguns.
I thought the Obama administration was taken to court with the idea that the regulatory stuff was somehow, I don't know, up for grabs in regards to the court system. I could be wrong. Maybe I'm misremembering this. But it was gutting the regulatory power of the federal government. But I could be wrong. Maybe I'm misremembering this.
I don't remember that rule. I'm going to have to look that up.
Fair enough, because I could be wrong. I could be totally wrong.
I mean, personally, I guess I don't have a huge problem with it. I mean, lots of dangerous shit. You see, when you drive on highways, you always see gas trucks. There's poison. There's as we know from East Palestine, Ohio, railroads ship dangerous chemicals all over the world. It doesn't seem like, as long as it's done in a safe way, I don't have a problem with it.
How do you know who you are shipping it to? Like, how do you know the credit card's not forged?
Well, that is actually a really good point. You can say that about anything, right? There's all sorts of dangerous shit. I mean, you could ship knives.
True.
The credit card could be stolen. Knives,
any random person can buy a knife. Uh-huh, there's certain regulations around who can buy a gun. Like, for example, if you beat your wife, They may have laws against you getting a gun.
Right.
But you may use somebody else's credit card to purchase that gun. I guess, yeah. I don't know. I'm dicey about this.
I am curious about what Robbie would have to say, since he's the only person here with a gun in the actual background of his image.
True.
Robbie?
Hey, Robbie.
I can't hear you. Oh, Robbie, you're muted.
Yeah, I just saw that. No, I have no problem with it. I mean, seriously. I mean, at the end of the day, the Second Amendment says what it says and it means what it means. It's the only amendment that says that it shall not be infringed. The element that says that it shall not be infringed. Now, if a state wants to outlaw it, that's fine. That's a local level. That's something that can be done there locally. The feds probably will push back on the interstate commerce clause of the Constitution. But I mean, guns are they are a legal thing that you're able to buy. And
okay. I got to cut you off because we've got a bunch of super chats we got to get to. We're going to do this rapid fire. Sorry, Robbie. Jack Samuels, thanks for the $4 for the $4.98 thoughts. Sorry, that one we already did. Don't do that again. Saul Goodman, Hantavirus. Do you see this as a 2.0 of COVID? And do you think a couple on vacation went to a landfill? I do not see this as a 2.0 of COVID. And I don't think there will be a 2.0 of COVID anytime soon. What do you guys think?
I have no idea. I don't trust our government enough to give them the benefit of the doubt on anything. If you're looking for a crisis, you've got to find one.
Sir Bikes-a-Lot, I can answer your question as to why minorities vote for the right. I grew up in San Antonio. They don't think that they're a minority until they get racially profiled. That's just a comment. I'll leave that there. Payupa, my friend works in Amazon as a supervisor. She works 12 hours night shift. Sounds like hell. Thanks for the $6.99. Scott Cove, thanks for the $5. 100 years ago, Robbie could have been a wobbly with the IWW, the International, what's the second W? International Workers something, like Bill Haywood. That's true. Robbie could totally have been a wobbly. Guys, I'm going to keep you both on to, and then you guys are going to have to keep talking about this because of the tech aspect to going over to the TMI show, which begins in 2 minutes. But Melania Trump was talking to a Mother's Day gathering of military moms, and she talked about how most people know my husband as the strong commander in chief. Most know my husband as the strong commander in chief, but his empathy transcends the role. And the crowd, this friendly crowd, laughed. What's it mean when the president of the United States is widely viewed as unempathetic?
Well, I mean, he was the one who's doing the Trump dance, in front of the military band after he announced he declared an illegal, unconstitutional war of aggression. So his fat orange self is just up there, just doing this in front of the military band. And he talks about, well, there's probably be casualties, but that's a price I'm willing to pay for you, for your sons and your fathers to die.
When he was murdering it wasn't even Ansar Allah. It was people who were out there praying or something, like some kind of event. And he put it on Twitter and was chest thumping the murder of civilians. Come on. They started the war off bombing a school of girls, of kids, of children.
Yeah. I just did a cartoon about how, we didn't care about that, but we care about $7 gas.
Yeah. I mean, yes, as Americans, yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. I mean, but the idea of the psychopath being empathetic is just outrageous.
Yeah, well, that's but the point is, to me, what's weird is that you could be president of the United States. Nobody thinks you're empathetic. You cultivate a reputation of being someone who doesn't give a shit about anyone but themselves. Why would anybody vote for someone like that? Why would anyone not impeach someone like that? I mean, having empathy is a core human personality trait. If you don't have it, there's something seriously wrong with you.
But you got to remember, it's about team politics. It's not the person. It's just the other person's team is worse than my team. And so it's kind of like, in the ancient Eastern Roman Empire, you had the reds and the greens, and they would have riots. So that's what started the whole Nika riots. That's what this is. There is no deep thought. There is no philosophy. There is no brand associated with this other than my team versus your team?
All right. Well, with that, I think I managed to do the TMI thing well this time. So amazing. Anyway, thanks everyone for tuning in. Please tune into the TMI show with Ted Roland Millichan, Robbie West Filligan. We're hoping to have Manila back sooner rather than later. We'll keep you posted on that. JT, great to see you. Have an awesome weekend. See you Monday at 9 a.m. right here on YouTube and on Rumble, and Q&A show on Monday at 12 noon. Don't forget that too. Talk to you later. Bye all.
Be safe.
And here we go. Pushing buttons, boys and girls.